P.E. Moskowitz is a journalist and former staff writer for Al Jazeera America. He's also written for numerous publications. They have written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, The Guardian, and BuzzFeed, to name just a few. P.E. has a new book entitled The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. P.E. Moskowitz, good morning, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
In going through your book, I was thinking that you're a journalist. You have a long history in the media. Was your decision to write about free speech based in part on that experience as a reporter, or was it based on something that had been sort of marinating in your mind for the past few years?
I think a little bit of both. You know, as someone who's worked in the media for many years, just seeing how, you know, we obviously rely on terms like free speech and a free press to publish what we publish. So, and obviously, that's a good thing. But we also have this very large misconception about what free speech means, and in some ways kind of get the free speech story very wrong and end up doing a lot of, I think, propaganda work for certain political factions when we talk about free speech. So, as you know, as I've worked in the media and as I've gotten more and more curious about this topic, I started getting, you know, interested in how we perpetuate, in what my view is this myth that we all have free speech in this country, and how we also kind of end up perpetuating right-wing talking points through our supposedly unbiased news outlets.
I think of an old joke that goes something along the lines of we're all equal, it's just some of us are more equal than others. And you know, I think it probably has a lot of truth in terms of the media. And yes, it's a recent problem, of course, with big players, corporations, organizations controlling the media. But this is really something that goes way back. You look at Hearst newspapers and long before that, maybe the town crier on the, you know, square in the community was being influenced in what he was yelling out to people going by. Has this been an American problem from the beginning?
Essentially, yes. I mean, I think that in a way that we're all equal, just some of us are more equal than others, like basically perfectly sums up the thesis of my book, which is that it's not that free speech is bad, obviously, but it mirrors everything else in our society, race, class, and all the rest. So the more power you have, the more right to speak you have, essentially. And that's been true through all of American history, you know, starting with who was able to run a newspaper and who was arrested or not arrested for protesting. I mean, our most famous quote about free speech, which I'm sure everyone knows, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. We usually take that to mean that we have free speech as long as we don't, you know, cause a ruckus that harms too many people. But what that quote actually came from was a Supreme Court decision in the early 1900s about leftists protesting the First World War. So, and the Supreme Court essentially saying you can arrest people who are protesting during times of war because they're causing too much of a ruckus, doing the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater. So, despite having all this kind of free speech rhetoric around since the founding of this country, we've also had immense conflict over free speech since the founding of this country with people with less power who want to change things in the government being arrested and jailed and persecuted for speaking out.
As has violence been a component for a long time? I mean, I know about, of course, some of the violence against union protesters back in the day. Have we seen this for a long time?
Excuse me. Violence has kind of always been a part of American history. I think it's something we like to gloss over a lot of the times, but, you know, no political movement has existed without violence, including the civil rights movement, including union movements, where lots of property was destroyed, where many people were arrested. And this question of violence versus speech has always been central to the free speech conversation. And I think we define what is speech and what is violence based on essentially political expedience. So if you look at today, if you don't have a permit for a protest, then all of a sudden your protest is can be deemed illegal. If you don't, you know, buy insurance for your protest can be deemed illegal. If your protest encourages somehow the threatening of private property or something, then that can be illegal. So we're always defining what is free speech and what is over the line of free speech into violence. And I think that line is always shifting based on our current politics. So if you look into the 1920s, you mentioned the union struggles, how pro-union people back then defined free speech was very different than how we define it now. They thought free expression included not only speech, but the right to essentially, you know, cause a ruckus, to break windows and machines and factories and essentially agitate for a working class revolution. And whether you agree with that or not, I think it's very interesting because we think of free speech as such a specific thing nowadays, but 100 years ago, it was something very different. It included action, and it doesn't today.
When did we decide not to include action anymore? Was that a gradual process?
There were a couple of things that happened. I mean, so after the 1920s, 30s, 40s, when there was lots of working class activism, you get the McCarthy era, you get COINTELPRO. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, McCarthy was the senator who helped jail thousands of activists, and you have COINTELPRO, which was the surveillance programs of activist groups throughout the 60s. And that really moderated how progressives and leftists thought about free speech, and kind of made them go more towards the kind of center definition of it, where, okay, in order to not be persecuted by the government as much, in order to not be accused of being communists wanting to overthrow the United States, we'll moderate how we do some things. So that really changed the definition of free speech and what activism was acceptable in the United States. And then in the 1970s, you have this kind of conservative revolution in politics where I think conservatives kind of geniusly captured free speech as their own political cause, and spent a lot of money and a lot of effort trying to frame conservatives as the truly oppressed people that, you know, that through political correctness or things like that progressives were silencing conservatives. And you kind of see that continue today, where you have, you know, a million think pieces coming out about, is it okay to cancel someone? Is it okay to protest someone who's speaking on stage? And the center of these battles is always conservative speaking.
We're speaking with P.E. Moskowitz, the book, The Case Against Free Speech. We'll be back with more after the break. We are speaking today with P.E. Moskowitz. They've written a new book, The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. We were talking a little bit before the break about how, in some cases, people with a leftist viewpoint have moved to center. In your book, you write extensively about the American Civil Liberties Union and some of the factors, the forces that have moved them at times to defend folks across the political spectrum. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think it's always surprising to people at how radical the ACLU used to be. We think of them as kind of a center-left organization right now, definitely firmly on the progressive side of things, but in no way a radical organization. But if you go back to that same time period where there were lots of union struggles in the early and mid-1900s, you see the ACLU behaving very differently. And just to give an example of that, in one case, some pro-union supporters bombed the Los Angeles Times building because the Los Angeles Times was one of the most virulently anti-union newspapers in the country. And they didn't mean to kill anyone, but unfortunately their explosion was larger than they thought, and it ended up killing some people. And the ACLU defended them on the grounds of free speech and free expression. You know, they didn't say it was okay to murder people, but they their defense was essentially, you have to understand where this working class anger is coming from, and that without allowing the working class to speak freely, they're going to end up with more violence like this. So that's how radical they were back in the early 1900s. Many of their leaders were avowed communists, and they really took a firm stance on, you must allow the free expression of the working class, or else you will inevitably have a more violent revolution. And then, as I said, you know, a few things happened in the 1930s, 1940s. You start having people being accused of being communists and leaving the organization. You have the ACLU being taken over by a more moderate wing that wants to focus more on legal victories than on defending, or, you know, like case law, essentially, making sure that free speech continues throughout U.S. history via the Supreme Court and things like that. And you get into a more a closer semblance of what the ACLU is today. And the true breaking point was in the 1970s when the ACLU defended the Nazis who wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois, the predominantly Jewish suburb. And they lost something like 30% of their membership from deciding to defend the Nazis' right to march. And their argument was that, you know, free speech is free speech and we have to defend it for everyone or else it'll go away for everyone. And that's how you kind of get the kind of ACLU you see today.
Do we worship free speech? It's obviously part of the First Amendment, part of the founding of America, part of how we view ourselves as a nation. And I'm not suggesting that it's a religious principle, although maybe for some people it is. And as a result of that sort of worship of it, do we have a really incorrect view of what the term free speech means?
I would say yes. And I think it's related to a lot of other terms that we kind of take for granted in this country, whether it's freedom itself or democracy. It's not that there's anything wrong with those ideals, obviously. You know, freedom is a great ideal, democracy is a great ideal, and free speech is a great ideal. But I think by kind of believing that this country has upheld those ideals throughout its history and that we value them more than any other country on earth, we've kind of been blinded to the material reality on the ground, which is that it's simply not true. And that's my biggest problem with free speech, is that it's not that it's something bad to kind of idealize. It's that it simply doesn't exist in the form we think it does. If you look at other countries, if you look at other Western democracies, even Canada or, you know, anywhere in Europe, they've gone along fine without the First Amendment, without the this kind of tool to say everything that is said has to be protected under one specific law. They have just as much free speech as we do. And so that kind of shows that the First Amendment might be a little irrelevant at this point. And I think more than irrelevant, it can end up kind of masking actual problems with free speech in this country. I mean, we have 2 million people in prison. We have undocumented immigrants being arrested and kind of disappeared throughout the states. And, you know, we just have people who are working 60 hours a week who can't afford to spend their time speaking on anything. So when you start to pick apart the rhetoric that kind of overshadows that reality, you start to realize there's a much deeper and darker reality underneath.
Europe has had anti-hate speech laws in effect for a while. I'm assuming that they've had time to evaluate those. Has it really impinged on free speech?
Yes and no. I'm not a huge fan of governments instituting laws like that, for the simple reason that governments aren't very good at deciding what hate speech is and what is not hate speech. I don't think it's impinged free speech any more than it's been impinged in, for example, the United States, but it has been used in some kind of sketchy ways. If you look at France, for example, I know that they view their anti-Semitism law to prosecute people who support boycott, divest, and sanction movements against Israel. And so whatever you think of that movement, I think it's a bad it's a bad sign that a government would boycott that form of speech or would outlaw that form of speech under as a form of anti-Semitism. That being said, those same kinds of laws have cropped up in the United States that prohibit people from participating in BDS, that make it illegal for governments to give money to contractors who support BDS, and the United States has the First Amendment. So it's not really a question of what specific law is preventing or not preventing governments from suppressing or not suppressing that speech. I think most Western democracies struggle to really uphold free speech no matter what the laws are in their books.
We are speaking with P.E. Moskowitz. They've written a new book entitled The Case Against Free Speech. You can join us today by giving us a call, 800-838-3760, or send us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. I have one or two questions about Charlottesville. The first is, I was going to ask you, are you willing to talk about Charlottesville? I know you've mentioned in your book that you've had some PTSD and some problems processing that because you were there when it happened. So the first question is if you're willing to talk about that. The second is that I wanted to talk about the more general implications of what that particular event meant.
Sure. Yeah, I don't mind talking about it. So I was in Charlottesville. I was there reporting. And, you know, as you can probably gather from this interview, I'm not an unbiased reporter. I take a side on things. So I was there, you know, both as a reporter and observer, but also kind of supporting the counter demonstrators because I thought it was important as a Jew, as a queer person, to be there and show up and show, you know, that most people are not Nazis or white supremacists and that we don't want this kind of stuff in our country. And I ended up being several feet away, maybe 5 or 10 feet away, when James Alex Fields rammed his car into the crowd and killed Heather Hare. And, yeah, saw that whole thing happen, got blood on myself, and, you know, I won't go into more graphic detail than that. But suffice to say, it messed me up mentally. You know, I've been struggling with PTSD and anxiety and depression surrounding that event since then. And obviously it was a terrible thing, but it made the book that, you know, which I'd already decided to write before Charlottesville, it made it completely different in my mind because free speech no longer was an abstract concept to me. It was something that had tangible life and death consequences. I think everyone forgets that the Charlottesville march before it turned deadly was billed as a free speech rally, as a rally to preserve the free speech of you know, the Confederacy through statues and to preserve the free speech of white supremacists and Nazis. And we've forgotten that that's how it was billed, and that's how they kind of protected themselves from any illegal prosecution before it turned deadly. So that, you know, being so close to it, being so affected by it, really opened my eyes to what the consequences are when we talk about these things.
I'm wondering, you know, obviously a free speech is fine if you're sitting around the dinner table, I suppose, arguing with family at Thanksgiving. But at what point is action justified, or is it ever counteraction? Is that of course, you can defend yourself, obviously, if somebody tries to attack you. But it seems like there's a little bit of a fuzzy gray area there. I know you mentioned that you're not a fan of legislation to try to deal with this sort of stuff. But I was just wondering, how do you get around that tricky idea of action as related to speech?
Sure. I'm not sure we ever will get around that area. I think no matter what, you are kind of defining some speech as good and some speech as bad. And to give you an example of today, you don't even have to look at protests or anything controversial, but we already take so many limits on free speech for granted that, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that we think we have a universal right to it. I can't walk into someone's house uninvited and start speaking my thoughts I can be shot by them legally in many states for doing that. I can't go into a Walmart and start photographing. I can be kicked out because that's an infringement on their private property. I can't sell a Lady Gaga song as my own because even though it's my right to say a Lady Gaga song because that's a copyright infringement. So we already have many, many, many limits on free speech, and really our only truly free speech supposedly is free speech on public property, free speech that's permitted and sanctioned by your local or state government as being safe, free speech that doesn't threaten anyone, free speech that doesn't infringe on anyone's private property. So we already have all those limits in place. And I think that's really important to point out, because when people say, oh, it's a slippery slope if you start, you know, punching Nazis, or it's a slippery slope if you disagree with them marching on the streets. Well, we've already accepted the slope. We've already accepted many limits on free speech. And for some reason, we only get angry at that limit on free speech when it involves Nazis protesting in the streets.
Nobody seems to like a Nazi. They show up in almost all movies, don't they? one of your chapters, and I'd like to get into this about college campuses, I guess. Mm-hmm. Chapter two, you've entitled, Are We All Snowflakes? I love that. are we all snowflakes? I mean, are college kids today overreacting? Back in my generation in the 70s, people thought we were overreacting to things, and maybe older folks have always thought that about younger people. But is everybody, because of social media, is everybody a snowflake today?
I think yes and no. I mean, I think everyone has the right to be sensitive and to, not want to be offended by things. I do think social media puts us in this very strange position where, you know, there were Nazis before social media, obviously. It's just that I wasn't forced to view what they were saying all day, right? Mm. Whereas if I'm on Twitter, all of a sudden their content is right in front of me. So it's this strange world we live in where before social media, before the internet, things were more private, and therefore you could probably get away with saying things that other people wouldn't like without kind of being challenged on it. But that being said, I think we've always been offended by things. I think there's always been fights over what people can and can't say. And I think the specific example of college campuses is another great example of how this rhetorical tool of free speech has been captured by the far right and used to kind of push their agenda. So if you go back to the 1970s and you look at essentially when the Koch brothers and your regular usual cast of billionaires got together and started planning their own conservative revolution, they put in millions and millions of dollars to changing policy and changing people's minds through the lens of free speech and related terms like the free market and freedom and, the ability of capitalism to self-regulate and all those kinds of things. And, they were very blatant in their attempt to do this. It's not some kind of conspiracy theory. You can read about it in my book or elsewhere. But they basically said, we have to be dishonest. We can't just say we want lower taxes. We can't just say we want environmental deregulation. We have to say that these are concepts in relation to freedom. And that's the way that we'll get people to kind of buy into our revolution. And so they funded hundreds of schools at universities. I think the Koch brothers now fund 313 schools at universities. They funded professorships and books. They funded studies and academics and think tanks. And all of a sudden, once they started funding these things in the late 1970s and 80s, you get to the early 1990s PC crisis, where all of a sudden there was a slew of books about how college students were too politically correct to accept conservative ideas, where America was becoming too sensitive. Newsweek even ran a cover story calling college students the new fascists.
Hmm.
So that was all a very purposeful kind of rhetorical attempt to make conservative thought seem oppressed and dangerous.
So it was intentionally engineered to look that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think we're kind of still living with the consequences of that today. I think one of the sadder things is that liberals have kind of fallen for this engineered strategy. You see in the pages of the New York Times, you see in the pages of the Washington Post and the Atlantic and everywhere else, these same theories that college students are just too sensitive to handle challenging content and that they're quashing other people's free speech. But it's kind of ridiculous on its face when you start to pick it apart. First of all, isn't protesting someone on a college campus a form of free speech in and of itself? So whose free speech matters in that context? Does the right-wing provocateurs or does the college students? Those are both examples of free speech. And to say college students are stepping on free speech and therefore should be quiet ignores that they're expressing their free speech. Second of all, if you look at colleges, they're some of the most restrictive speech environments in the world already. I mean, our admissions processes, free speech violations, is if I don't get into a university, is that a free speech violation? If they don't hire a professor, is that a free speech violation? If something is taught in class but not another thing, is that a free speech violation? They are some of the most restrictive environments that exist. So I think it just goes to show you how far we've come to kind of accept this rhetoric of free speech as real and true and something worth fighting for, and kind of have done the bidding of the right wing of this country in the process.
The book is entitled The Case Against Free Speech. We're speaking with author P.E. Moskowitz. A short break here, and we'll be right back with your questions and comments on the Jefferson Exchange. Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. Author P.E. Moskowitz joins us. We were talking a little bit before the break about how money has influenced a lot of this and affected us. I don't know, you write in your book about going to Standing Rock and speaking with Rattler and Olive. And I don't know if they're a good example of this, if they have indeed been ones who have been influenced by this because of a poverty issue. We're trying to get P.E. back on the line right now. We had a break on that. But I'll tell you a little bit about the story that there was an effort there for people, obviously, to come together. Most folks are understanding of that and what it means. But one of the individuals who goes by the name of Rattler, that was his nickname, also was a protester and trying to keep things safe and secure for his people at some point in time in an altercation and ended up in prison on an assault charge. And there was a lot of concern about the damming of rivers and diverting that for the exploration process. And, of course, that created some problems for everybody involved in that. And eventually, as I said, went to prison. There were a number of protests during that, and at some point in time, it seemed like it was mainly money versus those who not, which is not uncommon on Native reservations. P.E., could you talk a little bit about that Standing Rock episode?
Sure, and the call was dropped for a few seconds, so I might have missed some of your questions.
I was just giving a brief, probably poor recap of what happened at Standing Rock, but talk about that, especially in terms of how it's very difficult for people of marginal resources to be able to stand up against billionaires, basically.
Sure. I think it's always important to point out that this book is not just you know, some kind of long think piece. This is a book of reporting. I went to Standing Rock. I went to Washington, D.C. to interview the defendants during the J20 protests. I went to several college campuses from Middlebury to Evergreen in Washington. And I really, you know, got on the ground of where these free speech fights were happening to kind of see what was really going on. And Standing Rock, I think, is one of the saddest and most prominent examples of the kind of free speech power dynamic we have in this country. I mean, it was largely peaceful protesters, thousands of them, largely on public land, and yet they were arrested. They were kicked off. They were surveilled by the federal government and by state government of North Dakota and South Dakota. And essentially not allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights. And I went there after Standing Rock as well to interview someone who is now spending, I think, 7 years in prison for participating in lighting a fire at the camp one night that police said was dangerous. There was no proof it was actually dangerous. No one got injured, but he's spending 7 years in prison. He's a Native American man who goes by the name Rattler. And it was just so sad to go and see his kind of goodbye party that he had with all of his friends who wouldn't see him for the next 7 years. And it just drove home this point that not everyone has free speech in this country, and that when you're pushing against these powerful forces, whether it's Standing Rock, whether it's sit-ins during the Civil Rights era, even if what you're doing is completely legal and under the banner of free speech, you will still be prosecuted, and free speech will suddenly disappear if it's something that the government does not like.
The government has a long history of shadowing people, don't they, and intervening.
Yes.
Tell me.
They do. And
I know that, especially because it triggered my memory when you mentioned the Black Panthers and what went on there. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So after the McCarthy era, where I think many in the federal government realized you couldn't just blatantly prosecute people without some guise of something going on, because, you know, the public would get too angry at it. Although it's always worth pointing out that the majority of people were in favor of what McCarthy was doing in this country. So we're not this free speech absolutist we necessarily think we are or haven't been throughout U.S. history. But after the McCarthy era and the kind of embarrassment of that, they turned to these more covert tactics like COINTELPRO, which was a surveillance operation on essentially every activist group in the United States that was you know, anti-capitalist, pro-black nationalist, and those kinds of things. So you had people infiltrating those groups. You had constant surveillance on them. You had some very strange operations where people would be duped into, you know, thinking they were doing something for the cause, but they were really doing it for the FBI and getting arrested. The FBI also came up with these very cockamamie ideas of how to influence these movements. They would send groups that they thought were doing lots of psychedelics these weird postcards with pictures of talking frogs on them, saying that communism, you know, the frog was saying something about communism being bad. Just all these very ridiculous attempts to kind of break apart these movements. But unfortunately, in a large part, it worked, not because everyone was being surveilled, but because everyone had to be under the impression that they might be surveilled at every moment. So it caused a lot of distrust within movements. It broke up a lot of groups. And it kind of, yeah, I think we're still dealing with the reverberations of that today. And unfortunately, it's still going on. I mean, there's tons of proof now that Standing Rock activists were surveilled. One of the most prominent ones who's in jail now, Red Fawn Salas, her boyfriend at Standing Rock ended up being an FBI agent who was undercover trying to essentially get her arrested. And you see this with the Black Lives Matter movement. You see this with other pipeline protests. It's just the same thing, just slightly more covert these days than I think it even was then.
The book is called The Case Against Free Speech. Author P.E. Moskowitz joins us, and you can join us as well. Give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. You know, most of the tech companies seem to have, maybe out of Silicon Valley, at least there's a public perception that they are left-leaning kind of organizations, maybe left libertarian. I don't know. That's the perception, I think, especially if you see the heads of some of these companies, the heads, you know, of like Amazon and Facebook and what have you. But in effect, I mean, because of the nature of these organizations being so large, so powerful, and so wealthy, are they really more conservative than they are liberal? I'll tell you a quick thing. This goes back many, many years. My dad used to say, if you're a Democrat and you make more than $100,000 a year, you're a Republican, admit it. And so I wonder sometimes when I look at these big tech companies, they are at least on the surface claim to be liberal and liberal in their policy toward their employees. But some of their business practices and their influence, especially as we look at what's happened with Facebook and the issue of so-called free speech, just wondering, if is that really a conservative culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think they tend to be socially liberal, which gives them this guise of being friendly. You know, they're pro-gay marriage and pro-expressing yourself and all those kinds of things. But they're also pro-corporate consolidation and having as much power as possible. So, and those two things don't really line up in any kind of coherent political spectrum or philosophy. But I think it's imperative for people who view the internet as this kind of arena of free speech, which is how we're often, you know, presented the internet as, and how we've been taught to think of the internet, to actually know the history of the internet. To know that it was a government military surveillance tool when it first started to spy on activists in Cambodia and Vietnam, and then they brought that technology home to use the internet to compile massive databases on leftists and other activists in the U.S. And then that technology was privatized into the hands of a few essentially libertarian tech leaders, starting back with Netscape and the founding of Wired magazine in the early 1990s. So fast forward to today, I think that philosophy is still, you know, kind of rampant within the tech industry, a kind of do whatever you want social philosophy mixed with this hardcore libertarianism of whoever, you know, wins the most goods deserves it. And that's why I think Google, Facebook, et al. Have no problem becoming the monopolistic powers they are today. And they've kind of become indistinguishable from the governments that are supposed to regulate them in the first place. I mean, the largest contractors out there right now are places like Google and Amazon, working with the military, working with ICE, working with the federal government in many aspects. And, you know, they conduct surveillance on their users. They determine what's okay and what not okay to say on platforms. They're really you know, these powerful surveillance and advertising operations more than they are any kind of platform for free speech. So it's not that you can't do good things online. It's not that you can't, you know, speak freely online. It's just that that's not the point of these companies. The point of these companies is to make money through government contracts and through advertising, which relies on surveilling you.
In the just few minutes that we have left, I wanted to ask you basically a two-part question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the near-term prospects concerning free speech? And is there anything that we as people can do to try to safeguard against some of the abuses that occur under the name of free speech?
I would say I'm an optimistic pessimist or an optimistic realist. You know, things are obviously pretty bad right now. This administration is not a friend of free speech. They're persecuting activists more than ever. And I think it's really important to frame immigration issues and prison issues as free speech issues too, because while we complain about who is speaking on college campuses, you know, there are millions of people not allowed to speak to the public in prison. And why is that not a bigger free speech issue than Milo Yiannopoulos on a college campus? I'll never understand that. So I'm a pessimist in that way, that I think that things are pretty bad right now. I'm an optimist in the sense that I think that, you know, human ingenuity and human, the human will to change things for the better is always there and always growing, and, change is always possible. The thing I think we have to get away from is this kind of respectability politics that are practiced by, you know, the op-ed pages of our biggest newspapers, of the kind of mainstream political discourse in this country. If we just think that we respectively ask for things to change, if we stay within the legal bounds of what is right, you're going to get prosecuted anyway. I mean, look at J20, look at Standing Rock. People were arrested for doing nothing except being there. And so I think that shows that we have to get away from this idea that there's ever going to be a time, and there never has been a time, where you can do things that are good for this country that aren't going to get immense pushback from the right and from the government. So I would just encourage liberals, especially who want to change things, to realize that in order to change things, you're going to have to anger a lot of people.
As a former journalist myself, I'm sure we'd both agree that support good journalism. We got to put money into people who do quality reporting.
Right, and who actually, you know, are on the ground showing what's happening, the consequences of the Trump administration's policies of really arcane policies, instead of just, you know, paying people to pontificate on the op-ed pages of the New York Times.
Very true. The book is The Case Against Free Speech. We've been speaking with P.E. Moskowitz. The subtitle of this book is The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. You can even get it from that big bad Facebook, can't you? or anywhere else in bookstores.
Yeah.
And you can read about this.
Google it or get it on Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. And read all about the influences, money and otherwise, that are on free speech in our country. P.E. Moskowitz, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.